Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Iraq's newly selected politicians are settling into their offices this week. There's a president, two vice presidents, a prime minister, and a speaker. On the face of it, all one more step toward self-government at a time when Iraqis will not only manage their own affairs but handle their own security. American military leaders say they're thinking about reducing U.S. forces by some 40,000 soldiers this time next year. There are, however, still warnings that Iraq's future is far from secure. This hour, we'll talk with one of the Boston Globe correspondents based in Baghdad, Thanasi Kambanis. He says that while some see progress in Iraq, there are also signals of something much more frightening. Instead of moving toward democracy, he says Iraq is at risk of turning into an ethnically polarized state, with the threat of winding up in a civil war. Well, we'd like to hear from you this hour. Do you think that Iraq will make it, make the shift to democratic rule? Or is the country doomed to endure more attacks and infighting? And what's the U.S. supposed to do? Is it obliged to stay as long as there's sectarian violence? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, normally when we talk with Thanasi Kambanis, he is at the far end of a distant telephone line in Baghdad. He has been in Iraq since March of 2003, living in the capital city there. But he's joining us this hour from a studio at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanasi, nice to have you with us.
Good to be here, Dick.
Okay, what about this news last week that, as you know, we read about it in the newspapers, the political logjam had been broken. All these politicians who'd been mooted about for the past 2 months were finally given their positions. Are we not to see that as some kind of progress?
I think it's certainly progress that Iraq has a government after 2 months where they couldn't sign new checks, as it were. But what we see here is a sort of last chance for the moderates in Iraqi politics to try and salvage their national and sort of forward-looking way of approaching the new Iraqi government against the very voices that caused this two-month gridlock. And those voices were folks who were asking for more for their groups. So we had moderate Shiites sidelined by hardliners in their own party, same with the Kurds, same with the Sunnis, and that's what kept this new government from being seated until last week. Now these folks have been given the chance to try and shape a government that is in their image of a sort of non-sectarian and nationalist Iraq, and I think they're going to have a really tough task ahead.
Is there something, how do I put this, in that attempt, Thanasi, to be so careful and make sure that everybody's represented? So you've got a Kurdish president and you've got a Sunni vice president, you've got a Shia vice president and so on. In being so careful to make sure that everyone is represented at the top, are they kind of in a backwards way then reinforcing the you're on my side or you're on their side notion of Iraq politics?
I mean, I think these guys are in a horribly difficult position because there's no good way out. I mean, if you take the approach that we're not going to care what ethnicity or sex someone is and we just want the best leaders for Iraq, as many of the secular and nationalist leaders have been saying for years, what happens if you end up with a government that's 60% Sunni, when the country is anywhere from 10 to 40% Sunni? You create a huge backlash from the Shiite majority, and so on and so forth with each part of this ethnic puzzle. So what happens is when you talk to people in private, they all say, we don't want to be Lebanon. We don't want to be a country where there's an ethnic formula, where the Sunni, the Speaker of the House is always a Sunni and the Prime Minister is always a Shiite and so on and so forth. And that was a big part of the argument the Kurds made to get a Kurdish president. But everyone is incredibly self-conscious and aware of what the ethnicity of every single person involved in the political equation is. Because even if they as individual politicians don't want to think that way, they know that the people are counting and the people are watching. So particularly the Shiites and the Kurds are watching to see if they'll get their fair share for the first time. And on the other side of the seesaw, the Sunnis are watching and they're saying, well, you know, before in the old Iraq where no one cared what ethnicity anyone was, we had the lion's share of all the power. And now we're watching to see what tiny sliver is thrown our way by the new governing majority to determine whether this is a grave insult or whether this is something we can live with.
Now, Thanasi, I know you've been on the road for the past week or so. We've actually got a line through to Baghdad. Jill Carroll is joining us from there. She's a freelance reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Hello, Jill.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thank you for asking. I'm interested in knowing from you what people in Baghdad are saying right now about the appointment of these new politicians. Is this seen to be good news in based on what you're hearing?
I think the general feeling is a sense of finally. I mean, they were really getting fed up, really frustrated. Even among Shiites and Kurds, who have the most to gain by allowing the process to go forward, were really frustrated by the lack of talking, the lack of formation of a government to even, you know, help them improve their basic services, and the need for living here. But the thing is, there's a sense of euphoria, kind of like we saw after the election, not to the same degree, but somewhat. And while people are happy now, something is moving forward, it won't last forever. I think one thing to keep in mind through all this is while they're happy now, it could easily deteriorate quite quickly in 2, 3, 4 weeks if the government that's formed doesn't produce some results on the ground for them.
Now, my notes tell me that this fellow who's the new prime minister, Ibrahim Al-Jafari, has to appoint a cabinet next. Is that going to attract much attention, or are we getting pretty far into the sort of nitty-gritty and minutia of politics in terms of what people are paying attention to?
Well, people are going to be watching that pretty closely because, like you were talking about before, I mean, well, everyone talks about unity and everyone will tell you that, yes, we're all Iraqis, we're not Sunnis or Shiites or Kurds. They are keeping score about who has how many ministries, who's in charge of what. And all that was hashed out between the Kurds and the Shiites before they were voted on the president. So it's going to go forward. It'll happen probably in the next few days. And I think people will be keeping a close eye on how many ministries, particularly the Sunnis, can get.
And can you just finally, Jill, give us a quick picture of what life's like on the street in Baghdad there? Is it still unsafe? Is it still a place where you have to be very careful when you're out looking over your shoulder?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the one thing that most Iraqis will tell you, that they want more than anything, more than democracy, more than a vote even, is just some safety. People feel concerned even leaving their homes, afraid of just random criminality, never mind the car bombs and other kinds of things that are going on. It's still a place where, as a Westerner, of course, you can't be seen on the street and identifiable as a Westerner. It's still a place where women fear being kidnapped or raped. Even if it's an unreasonable fear, they still feel it. And while there probably hasn't been a numerical increase that you can prove statistically in maybe the crime the past few months or something, people still feel that fear and they're afraid to leave their homes or afraid to leave at night in particular.
Jill, thanks for being with us. Keep your head down.
Sure, thank you.
Jill Carroll, freelance reporter for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. Back to Thanasi Kambanis, who's with us from a studio here, stateside. And Thanasi, the question of security, as Jill was saying, does that come first, before everything, always?
Well, it does in terms of the equation of everyday life, but it doesn't right now in terms of politics, because for the first time since the invasion more than 2 years ago, the political future of Iraq is really in the hand of a group of Iraqis that have some popular credibility. And everyone, I think, admits that the security problem is going to take a long time to resolve, that no one could solve the insurgency in a month or in a half a year. But they do know that a constitution is going to be written for Iraq either in the next 2 months or in the next 8 months if they get this six-month delay. And that is going to be a document that they're going to have to live with for a long time. And that's going to be this next year is going to determine whether Iraq ends up how much better life in Iraq is than it was under Saddam, or how much more freedom some minority groups have, or how religious the country is going to be. And everyone is acutely aware of the long-term importance for their quality of life of those decisions. So when the insurgency settles down in a year or 5 years, they're going to be left with whatever government they pick now, whether that's one in which the imams have a disproportionate amount of power, or whether that's one in which ethnicity is the ticket to success instead of Ba'ath Party membership. And folks are starting to talk about that a lot, as well as the old, the enduring concern that they've always had about safety.
I wanted to see if I could get you to put this question of identity politics into a context that raises it into that danger level as you see it. I mean, we talk about identity politics, as you know, in this country. I'm from the North. I'm from the South. I'm with the Christian right. But in Iraq, to be with whatever organization or neighborhood or church or religion or mosque, why is that so poisonous when we look at the country's future?
Under the decades, during the decades during which Saddam Hussein ruled Iraq, the official position of the Ba'ath Party was nationalistic, non-sectarian. So formally, it did not matter one bit whether you were Christian, Muslim, Kurd, Arab, Sunni, Shiite. Those divisions were officially cast aside. And in fact, in his cabinet, he had members of every group. And success was, again, theoretically based solely on your membership in the Ba'ath Party. And that rhetoric governed Iraq for 30 years. And a lot of people who experienced life under Saddam still have incorporated that into their way of thinking. Now, the reality on the ground was that most of the people who were killed by the regime were Shiites and Kurds, so you actually paid a price with your life for being a member of those groups. That's why now those divisions become more important than we could relate to from the States.
We're going to pick that up when we come back after the break. Just a reminder to our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. When you look at the news from Iraq, are you seeing signs of progress, or are you also seeing worrisome signs as the country allies itself more and more with each passing day into a form of identity and possibly extreme politics? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Thanasi Kambanis is with us. He is a Boston Globe correspondent based in Baghdad. And Thanasi, I just wanted to come back to one thing that you were saying about the old Ba'ath Party saying, you know, we have to be for Iraq and non-sectarian, because somewhere I heard that there's even talk within the country right now, today, about people saying, hey, you know what? After 2 years of this stuff, the Ba'ath Party's not looking that bad. Is that serious?
That is very serious and depending on where you sit, very alarming. In the last few weeks before I left Iraq, I spent a lot of time going around and speaking to old Ba'ath Party leaders, many of whom are coming back into politics. And I think you might have actually heard that from me, because that's a quote from an interview I had with the former oil and defense minister under Saddam in the 70s and 80s. He's an old man, a dyed-in-the-wool Ba'athist, and he said to me laughingly and very happy, he said, a year ago when I talked to my friends about going back into politics and about bringing back the Ba'ath Party under a different name, they ridiculed me. They said the people will lynch you in the streets. And now, this is him talking, now people are nostalgic for the stability they knew under Saddam. And yes, people were in prison and yes, people died, but hey, they look around now and they see an insurgency. They see what looks like a budding civil war. They see occupation, and they think the order of Saddam's government wasn't so bad.
It just seems almost unreasonable. I mean, the Ba'athists, we have been told for the past 2 years, have been the people who've been backing the insurgency that's been aimed as much at Iraqis as it has at the Americans.
And these men, and they were all men whom I spoke with, all claimed to be close to the insurgency and to a patriotic wing of the insurgency, as they put it. And they said, listen, it's not about killing Iraqis or killing Americans. It's about killing collaborators with the occupation and protecting patriots. And first of all, I was stunned that this kind of discussion was something they felt completely comfortable having with me as a reporter for an American newspaper, and that they considered it politically viable. But furthermore, that they believe that the Iraqi public will support an insurgency that kills Iraqi policemen and Iraqi government employees as well as American soldiers, because all those people will be viewed as part of the occupation and the Quisling government that rules Iraq now. And I don't think that's anywhere close to a majority viewpoint among Iraqis, even those who I speak with who are very anti-American and very suspicious of the interim government. Almost no one, no regular person I ever talked to believes that the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army and the Iraqi government employees should be fair game for any insurgency.
I'd like to bring another voice into the program now. Dr. Anis Alraoui is Dean of the College of Science for Women at the University of Baghdad in Iraq. He happens to be on a speaking tour in the United States. He's got a few minutes to join us and has been listening along. Dr. Alraoui, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thank you.
Tell me what you make of all this. On one hand, we see politicians taking office, supposedly taking control of the affairs of the country. But on the other hand, we're hearing from reporters like the Nasi that there is this growing ethnic identity politics happening in Iraq that's going to become very, very difficult for people to control.
Well, you see, I mean, may I speak?
Yes, please.
Okay. You see, I mean, we believe as Iraqis that, you know, I mean, this to bring a new cabinet to Iraq, this new people who are controlling the country, just like the play cards. I mean, the people who came from the beginning by the American, they are now themselves. They are appearing in the yard. They didn't change their faces. I mean, even we have done election, a new election, but it means that the same people are appearing. For that, nobody would accept seeing the same faces. As far as you know, as I look at it.
Well, let me ask you, names like Jalal Talabani, the new president, or Ibrahim Al-Jafari, who's the new prime minister, do you want those men making decisions about Iraq?
No, never, because they are pro-Americans. I mean, I don't like them. Because, you see, I mean, they are... In Jalal Talabani, he has done nothing to his nation when he was, you know, in Kurdistan. And now Al-Jafari... He came by the coalition forces to Iraq. For that, he isn't new. He came from the beginning, and now he's taking another position. He was the vice president. Now he's going to be the prime minister.
All right, Dr. Alraoui, I want to ask you something. The president is a Kurd. The prime minister is a Shia. You are Sunni Arab from Fallujah. Is that part of the reason why you don't trust these two men?
Yes, really. Yes, I don't trust them.
And so who would you trust?
I trust the people who could be elected fairly, justly, by the subject, not the people, you know, whom been nominated to be. This is, I mean, I don't like. Anybody comes to me, anybody, whether Shia or whether Kurd, we used to be Shia and Kurd and Sunnis. We were all together. There were no difference between these spectrums. But now, because they are coming through certain, you know, policies, we don't like them to be. Because, I mean, Jafari is representing Shias, and this sector of Shias, even the Shias themselves, are not supporting him, like other groups and, you know, Al-Khalis groups. They are not supporting Al-Jafari. For that, he is not, you know... with a full support from the Shias themselves, not from the Sunnis.
Let's just imagine for a moment there's another election. If there's another election and the U.S. is not a part of this, then it's possible that only the Shia politicians get elected because they are the majority in Iraq.
They are not the majority, never. I mean, this is really unfair. Propaganda. We were the Sunnis. If you count the Al-Mosul, the second city in Iraq, if you say the Anbar, the largest city, the largest province in Iraq, if you look Baghdad, more than half of them are Sunnis.
Yeah.
The secret are Sunnis. I mean, this is not a real propaganda that the Shias are the majority, because 5 million of them have come from Iran. If there is a good calculation, and if you go back to the token, I mean, they call it there is a token, a forum token, to give it to Iraqis. If they go back to it, you will find Shia are not the majority.
Dr. Al-Rawi, do you think that there is a possibility or a risk of civil war in Iraq?
Well, a civil war happens when the Americans keep in Iraq. No civil war would happen if the Americans drew their forces from Iraq, because civil war would never happen, because Shias and Sunnis are not different, are not, you know, opposing each other. Even the Kurds, I mean, all the Kurds are Sunnis, and the Arab Sunnis, you know, we are in good relations with the Shia. For that, I don't believe a civil war will happen, because the imams from both sides are agreed not anything to happen like that. So it might happen that small, you know, areas get encounter attack, I mean, when there, but this is not going to be spread all over Iraq. I don't believe in that.
All right, Dr. Al-Rawi, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Anis Al-Rawi, Dean of the College of Science for Women at the University of Baghdad, Iraq. And in fact, one of the men whose names is often mentioned when they talk about putting together a cabinet, possibly as a Secretary of Education. Back to Thanasi Kambanis, who spends his time trying to sort through the different perspectives and statements that we hear from all the different sides here. Thanasi, the U.S. is frequently brought in as the problem here. Is the U.S. being brought in as a way of not talking about divisions that exist within the country?
I think often, I mean, bringing up the U.S. is a sort of code word for the things that are too complicated to talk about here. And I think Dr. Al-Rawi raised a lot of important points that we need to think about when we look at what's going to happen in Iraq. Number one is this idea that of civil war. He said he hopes one doesn't happen. Now, a lot of folks will say one has already begun there, and this is largely a semantic question. Most of the people getting killed in Iraq right now are Iraqis being killed by other Iraqis, and if you really parse it out, it's mostly Sunni resistance or insurgents fighting with Kurds in the north and with Shiites in the south. Most of the beheaded bodies that turn up on the side of the road are young Shiite recruits for the police or the army traveling south from Baghdad, killed by presumably Sunni insurgents. And recently we've seen vigilante gangs of Shiites organizing in return to go after the Sunnis they think are responsible for these killings. So number one, we already see some organized sectarian violence going on for many months now. Number two is this question of, you know, Sunni, Shia, are we different, and will the imams hold us back? What you heard there, I think, were echoes of a hopeful rhetoric, which is Dr. Rai was saying the imams are agreed that we will be try and be peaceful, and that most Shia and Sunni do not see themselves as different. I think that's how a lot of Iraqis would like things to be. But again, the reality is very different. If you go to Friday prayers, you hear a lot of imams, both Shia and Sunni, talking about identity politics, and not the kind of identity politics you referred to earlier, the kind we talk about here on American campuses, but the kind I was talking about, where it's the identity politics of will my sect survive a suspected genocidal campaign by its rival sect. Oh. And
all right, let's let some of our listeners here in 1-800-423-8255. Do you think Iraq's going to make the shift to democratic rule? What are you hearing, and what does it make? What makes sense to you? Let's go to Sudbury, Massachusetts, for our first call. Dimitri's on the line. Hi, Dimitri. What do you think?
I would like to say that I certainly hope Iraq makes it. But if you go back to the formation of the American government, the difficulties of growing a culture of pluralism was widely discussed at the time, and the political wisdom at that time was, no, it's very difficult to have political pluralism. And with Madison and Federalists arguing that there is a possibility with the proper conditions to have that happen, they were correct in the American context. But if you look at the recent history of ethnic politics, it is very not encouraging. For example, if you look at Lebanon, they had a terrible civil war. Yugoslavia have dissolved in horrible ethnic strife. Even something as nice as Czechoslovakia have divided into Czechia and Slovakia. So, unfortunately, it's not well known in American body politic, but it is a very, very difficult thing to do, to create a political pluralism out of an ethnically divided nation.
Let me ask you something, Dmitry, whether or not you think that there's any role for U.S. soldiers in providing a kind of security while Iraqis puzzle it out. I mean, is there going to be this kind of strife with or without?
I think at this point the American occupation is distinctly part of the problem and not part of the solution. The faster we get out of Iraq and the faster we move the security and all governmental function into the hands of the Iraqis, the better off the Iraqi nation will be.
Dmitry, let's hear from Thanasi on that. He's a lot closer to it than both of us. What do you think?
Well, I think we've witnessed a lot of problems that are born of the inability of the American troops on the ground to control spiraling violence. For example, if the U.S. had succeeded in the last 2 years in securing the area south of Baghdad, we wouldn't have seen that first wave of Sunni on Shia sectarian killings. Same with Fallujah. Fallujah got out of control because the U.S. couldn't police it in that first year of the occupation. So I think the answer to the question is if the U.S. could put a lid on all the violence in Iraq and keep that lid on tightly for 5 years, that would do wonders for creating political space for pluralism to develop. But there's no reason to believe that they have that physical capability because of the size of the nation and the scope of the violence.
And so without the numbers there is, as Dmitry said, the U.S. as much a part of the problem by staying.
I'm not sure about that, actually, because if you talk to those Shiites and Kurds who are for the first time seeing themselves have some political representation, most of them, even a lot of the hardliners, are glad to see the Americans there because they see the big security threat to Iraq as an internal threat from Sunni hardliners and an external threat from jihadists. And they see the American military as the most effective force to stand against those folks. So they want, this is what they've said publicly as well as privately, they want the Americans there until they feel like there is a real powerful Iraqi army and Iraqi police that's actually strong enough to take on these elements, and they know it's going to be a matter of years.
All right, let's take another call from Williamsburg, Virginia. Martin's joining us. Hi, Martin.
Yes, hello. I really get frustrated listening to the patent contradictions that come from the very same speaker. Dr. Arawi, on one hand, talks that he wants the Americans out.
Yeah.
He just says one thing after the other that contradicts itself. There is nobody that represents more of an even-handed approach that doesn't accord one group on a racial or national basis the right to push the other group around. The Americans, we have that in New York. We have that in America. We have a country where everybody can walk down the street and not want to shoot each other. And for them to talk out of both sides of their mouth that the American occupation is the problem, but we Shiites would be in control if the Americans would only leave and we were in control, we were a majority, all that is sophistry and garbage. And I just hate to hear that being presented by somebody like Dr. Arawi, who thinks that he can put this over on intelligent people.
Thanasi?
I think you meant to say Sunnis. Dr. Arawi was a Sunni, and he was
Sunni,
claiming
exactly,
the Sunni.
Exactly, right. I did. Right, it was Saddam and the Sunnis, right.
Right, and I mean, I think what your frustration, Martin, is the frustration of not just American diplomats in Iraq, but a lot of the Shiite and Kurdish, and to be fair, non-sectarian Sunnis that are out there. They're very frustrated with a lot of these voices that sound like they're saying there's no good solution except for what came before. Because when you sort of peel back the layers of the argument, you end up saying, so what do you want? And they say, we want the Americans to leave, and we want all the ethnic leaders to be sidestreamed, and we want there to be, we basically want the class that ruled before to rule again, but without Saddam. Not everyone who talks is saying that, but that's what a lot of them seem to be suggesting.
1-800-423-8255, Connection listeners. What role is the U.S. playing in Iraq's particular brand of politics right now? Is there in the process of trying to choose a cabinet, trying to take some kind of control, of their own affairs. Does the U.S. have much of a role there anymore? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. Thanasi Kambanis is with us. He is a correspondent for the Boston Globe based in Baghdad. We're talking about the state of politics as it is reported and as Thanasi sees it on the sort of ground level. He's joining us this hour from a studio in North Carolina. 1-800-423-TALK is the number to join us. I wanted to, just before I go back to our calls, Thanasi, ask you, are there any voices, rational voices of moderation? I mean, what we were just saying before the break was that if someone says, oh, we're all Iraqis, we're all behind one nation, you need to be suspect of those people because they're quite likely old Baathists or you know, trotting out the line of the Ba'ath Party. Is there nobody in that country that says, forget about being Sunni or Shia or Kurd, let's be Iraqis and let's see if we can build something based on that?
There are a lot of folks like that, and they're increasingly marginalized within their own parties. I mean, I could rattle off a couple of names that might be familiar to your listeners. Adnan Pachici, who is a sort of elder statesman of Iraqi politics, and he loathes ethnic and sectarian politics. And for the last 2 years, he has campaigned tirelessly as a voice of Iraq and not of any sect. He got less than 30,000 votes in the elections. He didn't even get a seat in the parliament. Now he's trying to cobble together a Sunni coalition, and it's sort of wrenchingly sad to sit and talk with this man and hear him tell you, yes, you know, I tried to call these Sunni leaders together, and then he sort of looks up and says, you know, I spent my whole life campaigning against this kind of politics, and now this is, you know, this is what I'm left with. Also, you see this in the Sunni and Shia groupings. There's a lot of moderates like Adil Abdul Mahdi, who's now the vice president, and these are folks who find themselves on the fringes of their own party when the strongest voices in their party are the ones who say we have to see ourselves as Shia and Kurds and fight for Shia and Kurd rights. And these guys are basically left losing an internal argument over how to look at the future of the country.
I mean, someone like Adil Abdul Mahdi, he was educated for a period of time in the West, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, most of the politicians that you see in Iraq now either spent long exiles or long educations in the West. Adil, who's an Islamist, began his political life as a Maoist, and he lived decades in Paris and speaks six languages. And he's not alone in that sort of cosmopolitanism. But what's surprising, it's surprising partly that these folks haven't been more successful at the internal argument. What's also surprising is to watch the tide of frustration eat away at people's cosmopolitanism to the point where they say, you know what? Yes, I'm Iraqi, but I'm sick and tired of my fellow Shiites being murdered by Sunnis who claim there's no difference between Sunni and Shia, and I've had enough, and I'm going to throw in my lot with Shiite leaders who will see ourselves and talk about ourselves as Shiites. Mm. And I've seen a sad but understandable amount of that happening among all the groups.
Let's go to Malone, New York, for our next call. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking that it was very sad that the United States decided to start the Iraqi war without the help of the UN. And the reason why I say that is that I live on the Canadian border. It took the Canadians 125 years to get a constitution, and that's between civilized, developed, educated French Canadians and Protestant Canadians of great mixture, natives, etc. It took them 125 years. What I'm saying is that you cannot introduce a form of government or a trust in the fabric of nationhood from the outside. It has to come from within. In the meantime, we need a legitimate cop. That might have been the UN. However, we've so botched it that the UN won't get near the place. So, in the absence of the UN, we have the United States. We are totally discredited here. If you look at Vietnam, they didn't have a civil war when we left. We can leave. We actually can leave. So my question then becomes, is there any reason to believe that between Israel and India, we are going to have anything but a religious state, in that the history of the area has not been able to lend itself to a nation of any other fabric than a religious state. And the second part of the question is, don't you believe that maybe the imams, in their education and in their basic following of their religion, that they don't believe, that they're not military by nature? Don't you think that maybe the imams of the different sects might be able to work this out better than the secular forces?
Let me, if I can, take the first part here in terms of you know, can any kind of democracy take root in that country now? I mean, the funny thing about it, Thanasi, is it's one thing for a politician to play to his constituency. I'm from Basra. I'm a Shia. Of course, I'm going to look after your interests. I'm going to Baghdad. We're going to make this country work. I mean, it's one thing to say one thing. I mean, it's not uncommon, I should say, for a politician to say one thing and then to work on a slightly different agenda. Am I being an unrealistic optimist by looking at it through that prism?
No, you're not. And I actually found myself just a minute ago wanting to say it's not all just cause for doom and gloom. There are because I raised this worry of ethnic war breaking out doesn't mean that I think it's inevitable. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's inevitable. And I think these people we just mentioned who are forces for nationalism and for unity might still prevail, particularly if they can figure out a way to solve the constitutional conundrum in a way that removes the sense of fear and threat from the minority and majority groups that are now sort of feeling backed up against the wall. So that being said, I think the caller's question about might the imams be better folks to work this out, I think the way to look at it is rather Iraqis are the best ones to work it out, not necessarily imams only. Imams have to be part of the conversation because they have a huge amount of public credibility and huge followings and the most direct line to the public. But I think it's all the Iraqi leaders who have real stakeholders, and the elections allowed us to see a little bit who those really were. But those are the folks who have to work out a compromise and a new government and build new security forces if there's going to be anything that lasts.
But if I just sort of stay on the optimistic side for a minute here, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, I mean, people look at his role in restraining, you know, the Mahdi army, the Shiite kids from the rough parts of Baghdad who are, you know, grabbing weapons and taking to the street. And people are saying, look, you know, these people, they can be a force for peace. Is that a reasonable way of looking at it or not?
They certainly can, and they certainly have been. I mean, Ayatollah Sistani has probably been the single biggest reason why there hasn't been widespread carnage and civil war for the last year, because he's repeatedly told the Shiites to wait for power to come through the ballot box and to not rise up violently against those who are committing violence against them. Now, I say it's a double-edged sword because, first of all, Ayatollah Sistani is a consensus leader of the Shiite clergy. He's a moderate quietist. He believes that the clergy should not have a direct role in politics. However, he's got to please his sort of council of Ayatollahs, some of whom are to the right of him. And second of all, the other thing that you have to really keep in mind is a moderate quietist doesn't mean he doesn't think that the religious authorities should not have a tremendous amount of authority. He just thinks they should exercise it by telling the politicians what to do rather than by being in political office themselves. And that's an important difference, but it's not a huge difference. So just like in January, he told all the Shiites that they should vote for List 169, which by and large they did. Now that's certainly seems preferable but I mean the Shiite dogma says if your marja tells you to do X, you can't disobey. And I talked to a lot of intellectual Shiites who said I wanted to vote for Iyad Alawi, but once it became clear that the marjiya wanted me to vote for the Shiite list, I had to vote for them.
Let's take a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Dua's joining us on the line. Hi, Dua.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I just basically had a comment. I'm an Iraqi-American, and I've been watching with an interesting perspective, because I both am in contact with my family in Iraq, but interact with Iraqi Americans in the U.S. And after the invasion, I noticed that there is an increased tension between the Sunnis and the Shia. Before the invasion, we actually got along quite well, and now there's a rift growing, and I feel like the propaganda, I feel like it is propaganda, that has been spewed from both American sources and Iraqi sources about the tensions that I think really don't exist. They offend me, and I particularly take offense to the comment that Dr. Anis Al-Rawi, because he's for Iraq, a unified Iraq, must have some Ba'ath Party philosophical undertones. Dr. Anis Al-Rawi, I know personally, and has never been part of the Ba'ath Party. So I really take issue with that.
I think that the challenge to Dr. Al-Rawi coming from the other caller was based not so much on that, Dua, but more on, saying that there is nothing that separates Shia and Sunni at the same time, as we hear so much, and again, from Iraq, not necessarily from American reporters, from Iraq, about Shia saying we need to look after our own interests and Sunni doing the same thing. I mean, there seems to be implicit in what he said a contradiction.
And that kind of attitude did not exist. I mean, in America, it did not exist before the invasion. And I can't pinpoint exactly what it was. But, I mean, in America, we were free. We weren't under the rule of the Ba'ath Party.
Who's we? When you say we were free, what do you mean?
Iraqi Americans. We didn't have to live under the Ba'ath Party, and yet there were not those tensions that exist now. 2 years ago, there were, or 3 years ago, there were not the tensions that exist now. And so,
I wonder, Thanasi, if that is in part because they have been released by the absence of Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, let me say two things. First of all, I in no way meant to imply that I thought Dr. Al-Rawi had any sort of Ba'athist sympathies, and if that's what it sounded like, I apologize, and that's certainly not what I meant. As to what you're saying, I think that that's true, that these feelings were released by democracy and also by the toppling of an order that made it illegal to talk about ethnic differences. And A lot of what's happening now is that people who felt like they were victims of the regime because they were Kurdish or Shiite are finally feeling free to talk about that. And we see a big split here, which is when this almost always breaks down on ethnic lines. When I talk to Sunnis, they say, we were all victims of the regime, all alike, all Iraqis, we all suffered. When you talk to Shiites and Kurds, they say, look at the Anfal, look at the mass graves in the south, look at who died in the Iran-Iraq war. We were 90% of the victims of the regimes. We were the ones, by and large, by the vast majority, who were tortured and had our toenails pulled out and who had our brothers and sons and fathers killed for draft dodging or for being suspected members of the Dawa Party, et cetera, et cetera. And now this is a fight over the legacy of victimhood, and it's also a fight over what is the ethnic breakdown of Iraq in the absence of a census. But again, it's a new part of the conversation because it wasn't allowed to be a part of the conversation before. Inside Iraq, I can't speak to what happens in the exile community, but this is what I saw happen from March 2003 when I first set foot in Iraq, and no one talked about their ethnicity—not Shiites, not Sunnis—and then over the course of 2 years, I found this increasingly front and center in what people volunteer when they talk about themselves.
Dua, look with me, if you would, at the characters who are at the head of the new government. President who is a Kurd and two vice presidents representing the two Arab, Sunni and Shia, and on down the list. Are you saying that you are troubled that they're being in part chosen because of who they represent?
Yes, I think that.
And how do you get around that? Because earlier in the program, someone said, everybody wants to know that someone up there near the top is looking out for their interests.
I think that we need to consider Iraq's interests rather than their own ethnic identities interests. I think that, part of the reason that we should really try to get Americans out of Iraq is that I don't think that Americans can, in fact, look out for the Iraq's best interest because they have to look out for their own best interest. And so I think that the only way for the nation to survive is to unify and rebuild the country.
The point, I guess, Thanasi, being that if you could snap your fingers and the American forces would be out of Iraq, would that put pressure on Iraqis to say, all right, let's just put aside our squabbling and see if we can run a country here?
Yes, it would put that pressure, but it would also probably create a context in which the security threat tipped so far that it would make any coalition in charge of Iraq prone to create a police state in order to control the streets. And I think what Iraq needs, and most Iraqis will tell you this, is it needs some real charismatic leaders who feel the way the caller just described, who are interested in Iraq's best interests and not their ethnic group's best interests. And so far, sadly, none of the politicians who feel that way have been particularly compelling. And that's, you know, that's
I
been one of the
great... I thought this fellow Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafri had some of that kind of public appeal in Iraq.
He has a lot of respect as a man of learning, but he's also a man who spent much of his exile studying to become a cleric who's qualified to make issue religious fatwas. And I think a lot of people, justifiably or not, I can't say, fear that he is a hardcore Islamist who knows how to speak reassuringly to the West and to Iraqi moderates. And he certainly is not a man with a lot of charismatic appeal. He's not a man who will get up behind a podium or on television and change a lot of people's minds or get a lot of people really excited for change.
Quick last question for you, Thanasi. When you're doing your reporting there, do you always have to ask? Do you always say to someone, "Are you Kurdish? Are you Shia? Are you Sunni?"
You pretty much know by the names and by what neighborhood you're in and where you are. And so what comes across from talking to people is how much they care what they are. So the real instructive question is to get to, how do you really see yourself? Do you see yourself as a Kurd who lives in Iraq? Do you see yourself as a Shiite Muslim? Or do you see yourself as an Iraqi who happens to be of this religion? And there's many answers to that, as there are people I've interviewed.
And you're going back soon?
Yeah, I'll be back on Monday.
Well, thanks for taking some time to talk to us. It's always great to get that kind of inside perspective. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanasi Kambanis is a reporter for the Boston Globe who's temporarily in the United States. He's been living in Iraq covering the war there since March 2003. We also talked with Dr. Anis Al-Rawi, Dean of the College of Science for Women at the University of Baghdad, and Jill Carroll, freelance reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She joined us on the line from Baghdad. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.